Welcome to Rockin' That Show, Episode 2, Attack of the Clones.
Attack of the Bones!
Huge bones. not Greg's bone, though. But welcome to Episode 2 of Rockin' That Show. As always, I'm Nick... welcome to Episode 2 of Rockin' That Show. I am your host, Nick Scalise. With me, as always, is my crew, Mickey Ferguson and Greg Shanahan.
Chalo, dude.
Again, Mickey Ferguson is an expert in female anatomy and in...
Yeah, I study it with my mouth.
And in hardcore dancing. And Greg Shanahan is an expert on the male form. But that was...
Super expert.
So, I guess let's start out this week with some more messed up kind of shit to talk about. I'm not sure how many people checked up regularly on what was happening at South by Southwest, but Cookie the Clown, we need to talk about that, guys. For those of you who don't know, that was Fat Mike of NOFX, correct?
Yes.
Bassist slash singer.
Slash owner of Fat Records, right?
I am obsessed with NOFX in a lot of ways.
Big fan, yeah.
Back in high school, I was obsessed with Punk and Drublic, So Long and Thanks for All the Shoes.
That's a sweet name, by the way.
Pump Up the Valium. There's tons of amazing albums by them, you know, and they're always known for their stories, but, you know, this has definitely brought to light something that's, you know, it's sad, but interesting. I think a lot of people were like, how horrible of him to okay, so the story goes.
Yeah, back a little bit of background.
Let's backstory this. Like, we all read about the articles, we all saw reviews, but I'm going to let Mickey Ferguson touch on this because he seemed to know the most about it.
Well, what he was set to do was act like this, his character, Cokie the Clown, and
go out. Which he's had for a little bit now.
Yeah, yeah. And basically play some acoustic songs, and he did play quite a bit of NOFX songs, but before he started, he came out with a tray of tequila shots and just passed them out to the crowd.
Well, he was also taking shots of it himself, correct?
I think it was straight from the Patron bottle itself.
Okay, he was just drinking
from the bottle. But he had a videographer who's videotaping him while this happens. Like, he came out with Fat Mike. Then it goes through the show, and they start talking about... Well, he starts playing some NOFX songs, then telling stories, which are pretty messed up, first and foremost. One about a woman being raped, which is obviously no laughing matter, with him and one of his bandmates... watched as she was carried off, and they were told to shush and not do anything about it.
During a show they were at, these men told them... She was screaming
for help, and I remember it said in the article about how, like, they, like, caught eyes or something for a second, but then there's nothing he could do about it.
Yeah.
That one hit me the best out of all
Stories, the other ones actually hit me pretty hard. The second story was one about... I think the talking about his dad was one, how he had a horrible relationship, wouldn't actually go to his funeral. But talking about his mom and her being in the hospital and him essentially, they do mention it in the articles. It's not necessarily an unheard of thing where the hospital allows somebody to pull the plug per se. He talks
right
about
of
putting
attorney, proof of attorney, what it
power
was.
Of attorney.
Power of attorney. Yeah.
That makes sense, but no, this you can't physically do that without him having that ability. Anyways, he says he puts the pillow to her face because of the amount of drugs that they put into her system did not kill her.
Yeah.
So he physically kills her. That's messed up and sad. And then he also talks about a roommate who hangs himself, isn't successful, and then does it again and manages to kill himself, and him and his friends go into the room and steal his belongings before the family comes over.
Mm-hmm.
And that's fucked up and sad. And, you know, and people, and the reaction people have been giving to these stories is, let's get to the end of it. He shows the video of him coming out before, pissing.
After his set at South by Southwest, he played the songs of NOFX and his own songs.
Yeah, the aforementioned videographer, they play the video, and it reveals the fact that he's pissed into the Patron, and then poured the tequila shots, so he gave piss/tequila shots to everybody in the crowd.
Okay, so now let's start this from there. Because, truthfully, okay, like, how you're saying that, like, a lot of people's reactions were just hating, like, really hard on this set and being like, oh, well, this is, like, disgusting and
what
all that
an
stuff.
Asshole.
Yeah. That, I would say is the only thing that I don't feel was necessary. Like, just because, okay, I mean, because with me, I wouldn't hate on somebody for that. Because, I mean, somebody like that, I mean, a lot of people looked up to that dude. He's very, very successful.
Well, it's not like people don't know that he has antics like this.
Well, yeah, but I mean, when you hear somebody tell stories like that, I mean, even though they're shocking to you and they're, like, depressing you, like, that's not really a reason to get pissed at somebody. And then, I mean, like, that is really the only thing from that set that I feel like wasn't necessary, because, I mean, maybe this was a cry for help or something. I don't know, like, what he was trying to do, or just, like, enlighten people with, like, hey, I've lived a punk rock life and, like, this shit's been nuts.
Yeah, there's,
like,
no joke that Fat Mike is definitely fucking punk rock. But,
yeah,
I think, again, to me, it rings as sad / interesting. I have nothing but pity. I am definitely empathetic. I can I feel like I can understand what it would be like to be in such a horrible, broken home situation where your father doesn't love you, and, you know, but
yeah, that's something else really quick that I found really interesting was that how he said that he didn't see his father very often, and his mom, like, made him come because his dad just wanted to party and, like, have fun, which is kind of like a touring band guy, you know? And so, I mean, I just thought that was interesting, that was, like, his father's attitude on life, and we'll continue on anyways.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's definitely interesting. Again, you can see it as this guy definitely leads a sad life, and it's definitely a response to everything that was earlier. I think he acknowledges it, too, which is kind of where you don't feel too bad for him. But I guess you can't exactly condemn him for everything.
Yeah.
Well, also, something that you forgot to mention. There's only one story that's kind of like half weird / I'm a freaky dude, so I found this really interesting. Mickey's smiling and tapping me right now because he knows what I'm talking about.
It's definitely a pretty hilarious story.
But at one point on tour, he met a mom that she had a 2-year-old kid or something like that, and she said that it was one of her deepest, darkest fantasies to be milked. Now, me as a person, I've been asked to do some crazy things sometimes, and if that's how you get your jollies, I will abide.
Well, to be honest, if somebody told me that, I don't know if I would indulge in milking a lady.
Well, if you're the one bringing it up.
Yeah, also, like, really quick,
listen, you want to be milked?
Not to be an asshole about that, Mickey.
Well, unless she's uber hot.
You haven't maybe been in a touring band. There are situations that you find yourself in that when you know that you're only in a city, like, one time for the next, like, 3 months.
You're drinking for the story.
Yes, the situation changes. And, I mean, granted, maybe in this extreme circumstance, I might not tie up a lady and milk her, which was what happened in the story. Sorry, I don't think that we really got into that, but I don't know. It's just that one made me smile a little bit because just the way that they phrased it in the article was like, and he was more than happy to oblige or something like that.
Well,
like,
that was the only, as in terms of the article, the only somewhat positive funny story.
And I like that that's the only positive.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, and that's not even
in terms
that
of suicide
positive.
And rape and murder and, you know.
You know, and yeah, definitely, I completely agree. This is, I mean, it's definitely a sad, sad situation. But incredibly interesting. I mean, everybody will kind of come to the conclusion, well, there you go. This is exactly why he's led such a fucked up life. So,
well, I guess in the realm of leading, like, crazy lives and, like, doing crazy tour shit, something else that happened this week, there is the May Day Parade video debut. And, I mean, granted, the content of that video is definitely not the same as Fat Mike's stories.
Yeah, it'd be a little bit even more intense. Got milk and chicks and watching your friends die. But
yeah, that would have been a very intense music video. But
on the other hand.
Yeah. So, anyways, May Day Parade debuted a video this week.
Kids in Love.
For Kids in Love. Thank you, Gregums. you're on point. Like the dicks you study so hard. But I mean, we all took a couple of times to watch the video, and I first came upon it I went to check Twitter one day, and pretty much all of my friends were like, what the fuck?
Yeah, my buddy Johnny said it to me, and he's just like, yeah, can you believe it?
Yeah, and so, I mean, let's just take a second and talk about this video.
Well, I've never been too much of a fan of May Day Parade. This current era of pop punk, I've always considered, you know, quote-unquote pop punk, I liked All Time Low the most. May Day Parade always seemed to fall. I never found it mentioning when they had the dual singers, they were most interesting. Anyway, all that aside, I feel like this video, along with their song, definitely brings new light to what they were doing, and I'm a big fan of it. I think it complements each other perfectly. The director, I'm forgetting his name now, but whatever happened with this video in terms of interpreting the song and what the band does, I think it was very well executed.
Well, I think the video becomes the focal point now. I think the song was mediocre.
Yeah, I will agree with you 100% on that, Mickey Ferguson.
And you know, and the other thing I could say is, I mean, kind of carrying over from Fat Mike, that Mayday Parade is not necessarily a punk rock band. They are, you know, pop music. They have tons of underage followers. I think that's what's such a surprising thing to it, is you feel like they do something G-rated for a video. Just a standard, we're going to play and then have some little tie-in and then that's it. But you look at it and it's like...
Yeah, truthfully, obviously people are talking about it. They're on Fearless, right? I'm pretty sure I'm like 99% pop.
Who knows?
Okay, well, I mean, either way. If not, please write us and let me know what label Mayday Parade is on.
And then we can interview you and you can ask what your actual thoughts are on the video.
Yeah. But, I mean, I thought that was just an incredibly ballsy move because, I mean, also, first off, I was surprised that you could stream it on YouTube, but, I mean, they made it where you had to be over 18 to see the video because of the amount of nudity in it. And then, I don't know. I mean, I'm going to retouch on the fact that what you brought up, Mickey, about how, to me, the video itself was the focus. Like that's all that I was focusing on, pretty much. Like, it was just like there was noise. Yeah, it's like there was noise happening in the background. And I was just like, what the fuck are these people doing?
At that point, it almost turned into a film. Like, when a film scores, like, their interpretation has to be to complement the film. And that is it. Not overtake anything.
Well,
and
it's cool in that regard, but it's to promote the band, though, you know? I mean, like, that's the product that's being sold, is the band.
That's true. So, but I mean, as a result, I like the song now.
And no offense to you guys, to Mayday Parade, but, you know, I felt you guys plateaued a little bit, and I feel like this is definitely kind of giving you a little bit new life.
Yeah, people are talking about you.
Again, and I can't imagine this music video costs too much. It's pretty, you know, pretty effective. The other thing I would like to say is the people a lot of people party like these people in the video do.
Mm-hmm.
I've done probably about 70% of what happened in that video. I've never dropped acid though, just putting that out there.
But the 30% of them, kind of fighting, I'm assuming they switched partners at one point. That's where they started to fight and be angry at each other.
And they're hitting each other.
You know, my verdict is, these people pretty much suck balls. Like, they look like they're shitty people, you know, and
road trip. It's like,
I just also want to put out that, as somebody who also very much enjoys running around naked, like, I like it a lot. Probably more than the average person does. Rolling down a sand dune naked and jumping through fireworks naked. Bad idea.
I would jump through fireworks before rolling down a hill of sand.
Sand in my pee hole is not something I am not a fan.
Yeah, I have a hard enough time getting the swamp out of there as it is. I don't think it needs sand involved.
Yeah, I don't know. In high school, I went to the Bahamas once with like my jazz band choir and stuff, and I got sand in my ear, and I had to go to the doctor about that shit. Like, it messed me up for a while. So I can imagine sand in your pee hole, fucking 15 times worse.
Oh, yeah, you get those candle cones you put on your ear, and you light it, and the air moves in the candle to ensure the oxygen is going to the can't, like...
That's actually supposed to be the most...
Earwax out of your ear.
That's supposed to be the most... How do we get to talking about that?
Yeah. Let's talk about earwax. No, but that is supposed to be the most, like, efficient way to clean your ears, because
apparently... But it's dangerous if ash falls down, and then it gets in your
brain. That's why you need to have a professional do it, because apparently, random fact, that when you use Q-tips, and I use Q-tips a lot because I like clean ears because I'm weird about my ears.
If you're a girl and you want to date Nick, you better have fucking clean ears.
Yeah, you better have clean ears because I like to suck on ears too. It's great. But anyway, so earwax. Let's get back on topic. Sorry, we got distracted by earwax.
But yeah, I mean, like, I feel like an effective video, definitely something to talk about, regardless if you feel like it makes sense at all in sense of the of the song and the band.
Effective, nonetheless. You guys are talking about, in terms of it being, like, not safe for work, 18 and over. Although, that aside, I still feel like it was tasteful enough in terms of...
Yeah, I mean...
It wasn't over the top. I mean, there was some nudity. I mean, yeah, they were fucking and some
things. I feel
like
you understand that these people... This is not...
They're real.
Yeah. Uh-huh. They're real, but I think as the viewer, people can agree, like, when they get to the end, they're shitty people. This is not approvable behavior. Like, behavior in terms of, like, partying is great. I love it. Mm-hmm. But the fact of the matter is they're swapping parties and they get mad at each other. That's not what friends do to each other.
Yeah, I mean, that... Like, okay, in that regard, yes, like, the characters... of the video are kind of, I mean, they're just kids in love. Whatever this is, however the song goes.
We're just kids in love.
But I mean, I know what you mean though. That like, I would say that it still was pretty tastefully done because even like the sex stuff. I mean, it never got over the top. I mean, like, I'd say the first part of the movie where or the video where you're just like, whoa, shit, like. No, I mean, there's just somebody like giving somebody roadhead, and
that's,
I mean,
that's
it just
the moment
catches
where
you
I was like,
of,
"What the fuck?"
Yeah, I was like, "Oh, maybe this," yeah. And then all of a sudden, yeah, then.
But you see I was expecting shock value, and in turn, I just got like, "Oh,"
it was like, "Okay, yeah, this like, is cool." Right, okay, yeah, but
so, I think it took a couple more watches.
Yeah, because I mean, I understand what you're saying, Mickey. People, don't fuck your friends' girlfriends. It's gonna be trouble.
The dude code.
I haven't been there, but I've seen dudes. Go there. It's never good. But anyways, talking about like people talking shit and people leaving things and people fucking things, I'm trying to make a smooth transition to the fact that John Nolan might be back in Taking Back Sunday.
Oh yes,
excellent thing to talk about.
Yeah, I mean that's a reason to fuck.
You know, clearly, yeah. I mean, their sophomore effort I liked, but nothing will beat their first album.
Yeah. Well, it's. I mean, it's hard to create such a defining album in terms of genre and style and have someone so accredited to that leave after that.
Oh, for real. I mean, you look at pop punk and then what happens after that. Nobody sounded like them. I mean, not like it was incredibly difficult to make that, but again, anytime make a transition in music like they did is something that's notable.
I'm going to try to elaborate a little bit on what you were just saying there because I agree with that record had a very unique sound. And...
Despite the clicking that, if you notice...
Can you hear
it
click?
It's poorly produced.
Oh, yeah, dude, yeah. Something really weird that I noticed in high school. Whenever Adam Lazar... I always get Adam Lazar and Adam Levine mixed up. But whenever Adam Lazar's vocals come in, if you listen really close on that CD, you'll hear a high-pitched... Only when his vocals come in. You'll hear it fade in a little bit right before his vocals start all the time. It's just a really high-pitched noise because whatever preamp or whatever they're using, not that hot. But that was a very unique vibe CD.
Well, see, that's a testament to the idea of writing something that is unique and original as opposed to something that's awesomely produced. Production in general is awesome.
Well, yeah,
Which
was the whole sort of baseline
for that
the whole
sound
emo,
of the record.
Quote, unquote,
I mean, yeah,
sound
I mean,
of the time.
Well, because yeah, I mean, that was definitely
about,
a low
what's
budget,
happening with
and
the music
yeah.
as opposed to how it's sounding or how it was.
Well, yeah, and I mean, like that Adam like didn't have like the best technical singing voice, but like the emotion and the rawness and like the aggressiveness.
Well, technically, he's a pretty bad singer in terms of that aspect, but in terms of style and finesse and what he's able to do with the mic.
So
and on stage.
Well, this begs the question, can they recreate what they had with John Nolan? Do you think that makes a difference?
I think that it's going to make a lot of a difference. I don't think that it's going to be the same thing that it was. But, sorry, the point that
I think people react.
Yeah, I mean, the point that I was trying to make a hot second ago was just how you said that was a unique record with a unique sound. Straylight Run's album, to me at least, was a unique record. I thought that had a unique sound, too. And I feel like John Nolan, like, brings a certain uniqueness. And, I mean, and, like, Taking Back Sunday sound after, I mean, it's been cool. Like, you know, it's, like, it's not bad. I mean, it's still Taking Back Sunday. But I feel like I'm just very, very curious to see what... I don't think it's going to be the same as the first record by any means, but, like... Because they've all grown and changed. That record came out like
junior and I have passion for Will Be Back. You feel like John Nolan when you hear him scream on that first record. I mean, they were high school kids being pissed about relationships and their friendships, and you feel like it's real. And you know how it felt when you listened to that record, and you hope that they can recreate it, or at least have that same kind of passion, albeit in some other form.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it'll just be a more matured passion, I guess, just because, I mean... They all seem like very similar people. I mean, and granted, their lives have changed like considerably, I'd say, probably. I mean, like, Taking Back's done big things, and then, like, John Nolan's gone and done his game. And, I mean, you can't expect any artist to, like, try to recreate, like, how they felt like 6 years ago. I mean, if that happens, I'd feel sad for them.
But it is going to be very interesting. You know, I've read at least in two articles or interviews or whatever, you know, my first experience with Taking Back Sunday was I was going to the Metro in Chicago to see Starting Line, and I was upset that they weren't headlining over Taking Back Sunday because I'd never heard Taking Back Sunday. Like, who the fuck is this band? Whatever. Anyway, Starline finished. Reunion show opened, if anyone remembers.
I love the reunion show.
They were fucking awesome. Anyway, but Taking Back Sunday took the stage, and they immediately they took over everything that was happening. I was hooked. I was in the pit. I was moshing to music I'd never heard before. But, I mean, they were able to make this connection with anyone who was there, like myself, who didn't know what the band was about.
Well, dude, even when you hear that record, that it had such intense energy. I mean, I don't know.
And it translated all the time, and when they were writing it, I mean, I'm assuming it's true, but because I'd read it at least twice in terms of things, like I said, but it was Nolan and Lazara would get together with their lyrics and with their music and be like, this is going to be what the album is. Like, as far as I know, they were the two that put together the album, and then they went to whoever's producing it and went with the rest of the band. But so, in that aspect, it'll be interesting to see them two back together again for the first time since they were 19, 20, 21 years old putting together Tell All Your Friends.
Yeah, because that's what I'm saying.
The magic,
I mean, like,
that happened in the first place.
They seem to complement each other well musically. And I mean, I'm just curious to see what will come from that. And I mean, and I'm not hating on Fred at all, dude. I mean, Fred's a cool dude. Like, he did a great job of taking those roles.
Big Fred fan.
Like, I haven't listened to too much Color or the Color Fred, but like, I don't know. I mean, I always thought he did a great job in that band, but I mean, John Nolan was John Nolan.
Well, yeah, again, every album was
a talented dude.
Every album after pales in comparison to the first. And
but there were
Fred
moments.
Was not a part of that. I'm saying that second album I actually enjoyed quite a bit. You know, again,
even after that, there are two albums after that definitely had their moments. It wasn't an album by any means as opposed to Tell All Your Friends, but there were moments on each album that were very, very good.
Well, and also, I mean, you do have to remember now, like, it's not the same game. They're on Victory, they're an indie band before and stuff, and then they got upstream to Warner. Like, you have to play a slightly different game.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I feel like Taking Back has done a good job. I'm not hating on them.
For the kids that are younger out there and listening to the show, I think the way to... it's hard to compare it, but you have to have been there and noticed the change between pop punk of that day and then Taking Back Sunday coming out. It's like Thursday, too. It was that post-hardcore, any of that music. It was just a definite, like, refresher. Like, and I'm waiting for the next step because right now I don't feel like there's ever going to be something like that. It's something like when Van Halen came out in the late, it was like 77 or whatever, and Eddie Van Halen had the 5150 going. It was just super hard. Mm-hmm. The guitar tone in that nobody had ever experienced, and then everyone after emulated them.
Yeah.
It's just one of those things where it's like you had to have been there to understand the impact it had.
What actually was happening at that moment.
If they can bring back the mosh to pop punk, I will be a happy
Well, they
man.
Do is, to a certain degree. I feel like if you go to a lot of the hardcore-inspired pop punk that's out nowadays,
I just see a lot of teenage girls just hanging.
Yeah.
Not that I don't like teenage girls hanging, but yeah, whatever. But anyways, talking about teenage girls hanging and kids bop and all these little weird things, let's talk about Fireflies and Owl City.
How girls changed.
Oh yeah.
Anyway, that'll be a different.
Yeah. I think that applies.
Greg
to all
hates girls.
General.
That's why he's an expert
that's why
in male genitalia.
Yeah.
But
he gets down on dudes all the time.
Yeah. Anyways.
That's why it's what I do.
that is Gregory Shanahan. But I'm pretty stoked about this. Owl City this week is now officially certified platinum.
OP.
Fireflies is definitely a huge single. And I like that song, don't get me wrong, but I love Ocean Eyes, right? Like, that was a
great album.
So I'm super happy that now the whole album has gone officially platinum.
I will say I was legitimately surprised when I heard about it. I knew that Fireflies was certified.
That blew
apart, you know? But I when I heard that it actually went platinum, it's like, wow, this is up there with all these huge pop records. As part of the Platinum Club. And
that's not a small feat by any means nowadays, dude. Like, not many people are going platinum.
Especially without any persona, for the most part. Like, who... Like, Adam, I don't even know his last name. Adam something. Like, I don't...
Was it Austin or Adam?
And it's something with an A.
I don't know, yeah, but yeah, but I mean...
To my point, like, it's a dude who has nothing to his name other than his music, and he's been making, you know, the most of it, and I...
He likes legit post-rock, like, I see the friends on his MySpace and all that, like Helios and Unwed Sailor. Amazing bands. He has good taste, but I think the big thing is, regardless of that, people have given him a lot of crap for him, quote-unquote, jocking and ripping off Postal Service.
D'Antel, yeah.
Yeah. I completely, I mean, like, I see where if you were, an untrained listener, I guess, I don't mean to sound, like, cocky saying that, how you could see that, because, I mean, his voice is kind of similar.
Even with a trained, quote-unquote.
Okay, yeah. I mean,
the similarities are still there.
Okay, yeah, because, I mean, it's obviously an inspiration. Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, but if you really then take a listen to, like, the core, like, even just the instrumentals, the kind of styling and tone that he does... I mean, it's more just like pop electronica synth, as to where Postal Service, I mean, there were synths and stuff, but like that dude did a lot of, what was his name again?
Jimmy Tamborello. He's from D'Antel. He's involved with a lot of stuff. Wrote all the beats. And I don't know if you guys know the story behind Postal Service. I'll just explain really quickly. They lived on opposite sides of the country. And when they would write, Jimmy Tamborello would write the beat, the music, and he'd send it over to Ben Gibbard, and Ben Gibbard would record his vocals and send it back. Mm-hmm. So the idea of mail, they named it Postal Service.
Which UPS picked up, ironically, and then...
Yeah, which is cool.
Well, yeah, that's
but Postal Service actually gave them a cease and desist.
Yes,
because of their name, and they settled for a concert for their employees.
Yeah, they played like a few exclusive concerts for U.S. Postal Service employees, and now the U.S. Postal Service, in fact, sells their CD. So
even though they're playing in UPS commercials,
which is also weird. That boop 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 boop. Like, sorry.
Anyway. But yeah, at any rate, it's something that I don't feel it is. Definitely okay to say that they have similar sounds. There's no doubt about it. People will talk about this. That is not
pop
under debate. That is not under debate that it is very similar. But that does not mean you cannot give him due credit. And I'm talking about Owl City. The synth lines he writes are excellent melodies.
That is not easy. It might sound easy because it hits you so fluidly, but that doesn't mean it was
music
not
in general.
Easy. Exactly.
Like you listen to the Beach Boys, it sounds simple, but it's the most complex harmonies. The amount of work that goes into that. And I'm about to compare Owl City to the Beach Boys. That's a bad comparison.
Oh, I don't think
to be honest,
anyway,
but the idea is that pop music is meant to sound simple but be complex in terms of work.
Yeah.
And so. I would definitely say that Owl City deserves due credit.
He does.
Hey, dude, I think that he deserves all the credit that he gets. I mean, that record is great. I love it. And I mean, in the realm of vibe, it definitely has a different vibe than Postal Service, too.
Well, Postal Service came out in, what, 2002, 2003?
Yeah.
That is so long ago to me. It's
if they were an active band now, that would be, like, I mean, sorry, I was going to make a Panic at the Disco Beatles comparison, but, like, I don't know. I mean, Postal Service isn't an active band, and I mean, I wish that they'd put out a next record. So you know what? Like, Owl City stepping in and being like, "Well, this is what I would do if you wanted a new Postal Service record, Nick. I'm gonna make a fucking hit record. Thank you, thank you."
Yeah.
I don't know.
In terms of you know, people who automatically dismiss Owl City, being like, "Oh, this is Postal Service. It sounds just like Ben Gibbard. This is just like boops and beeps." That is the
that's the only argument they have.
It's the boot. It just sounds like he. Granted, he does sing like him in ways, but I feel like that is the reaction of only someone who doesn't give a fuck about seeing anything else other than face value of music. You know, they hear the lyrics and they hear how it initially sounds first. Oh, this sounds like Postal Service. Fuck this music. But if you listen even slightly beyond those initial, you know, hook points of the music, you will hear everything. That is actually Owl City and what makes it different.
I mean, and you can tell that he's got like a Reliant K influence, and I know that he did
some
work with Matt Thiessen. Yeah, they co-wrote together.
Reliant K songs.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm a huge Reliant K fan, and so, I mean, that's definitely a huge difference there, too. All right, well, we're closing up on our discussion today because we're hitting about a 30-minute point, which is actually our longest discussion so far, which isn't saying much because this is episode 2. Attack of the Bones.
Bones.
Whale shit. Imagine if you were just hanging out in the ocean and a whale came by you and you're like, this is cool.
Oh, yeah.
And then whale. It took a shit. Power Space. And later on in the show, we have an interview with Field Bar Ramen A&R guy Johnny Minardi. So this show, we're going to be treating you to the music of a bunch of bands that he has signed, one of whom is Power Space. So here's another song from a Johnny Minardi band called This Providence.
Dreaming of me now, my love. He's just turbo.
It's a weird situation. Okay, so sixth topic. We're missing our counterpart, Nick. He sucks a lot.
Yeah, he's off doing things that are just dumb right now that not worth getting into.
You know, I feel like, honestly, you know, they talk about people being beaten with an ugly stick. He was beaten with an ugly tree.
Or even a house, like Wicked Witch of, or the Good Witch of the East. An ugly house fell on him. Just bad. A shock.
Hey, you've got a new dog.
My girlfriend's got a boyfriend funny. Doesn't make a dime all day. And all her girlfriend's boyfriends make money. What more can I say? It's true. He never made it through a day of school. The only thing he studied was you. He knows your body better than you. Boyfriend's girlfriend who's stunning. She's such a sight to see. It's true. The moment he laid eyes on you, he knew the only wish he wanted came true. He knows he's lucky that he met someone like you.
Starting with Johnny, okay, so what is your official title at Field by Ramen?
A&R. It's basically Artist and Repertoire, which, you know, there's a million different ideas about it, but basically it means find and develop bands for the label. That's okay. The simplest way to put it.
Okay, sounds cool.
So, I mean, besides just finding new bands, I mean, you're saying that you develop them. How do you go about that process usually?
It's an everyday thing, and, you know, I always say that, you know, no matter how many bands you work with, it's always, there's, every band's totally different, different timeline, different schedule, how fast they grow, you know, stay at the same level. Two bands are in the studio, three bands are on tour, one band's just taking it easy, you know, it's like different every day. But the development basically is, you know, I'm the in-between between a band and a label, I guess. When they need anything, they come to me first, then I go to the label and vice versa. You know, basically having the best relationship with the band and everything from coordinating tours with them and lining up the timelines and You know, the marketing of the record's a really huge thing, obviously, to coordinate between the band and the label.
Okay, yeah, I was going to ask, like, I mean, it, just in the realm of developments, I mean, how is A&Ring different from being, like, a manager? Like, do you get involved with, like, talking about image or, like, just direction of the band ever? Or, like, do you talk with managers often about that?
Yeah, basically, the manager we always look at is another member of the band, so we always kind of include them. There's never anything where, you know, there's emails going around about a certain thing or anything without a manager's consent. Or, you know, they always have kind of final sign off on anything, like, especially, you know, photo shoot or travel or any of that stuff. We don't just do it and say, hey, here's your itinerary. It's always very well thought out. You know, they're a big component to everything as well, you know, as well as the booking agent too is another piece of it that is always a huge, huge part, and a tour manager of coordinating the daily task when a band's in Colorado and we need to record tomorrow in San Diego. Like, obviously, you know, the person taking care of them, which would be the tour manager, has to point A to point B type thing with our help, obviously, but we always, you know, are working together to make sure sense of it all. So,
okay, yeah. So you're sort of the bridge between the artist and the rest of the label.
Yeah, that's a very simple way to look at it. So, I mean, sometimes, you know, like, publicity and stuff goes straight to, like, I don't do have to do the call every morning and be like, here's your schedule for interviews or appearance or anything like that. So, you know, there's certain aspects where other people come through and just, you know, I don't have to be a part of it all because it's such a, I guess, well-oiled machine at certain points to where it just, we all go and know the role, you know?
All right, well, next question. How did you get your job at Fillmore Ramen, Johnny?
Me and Tony, I had to go back and think about that one. Mm-hmm. We had a label back in the day called LLR, and the first record we ever put out was a band called August Premiere, which then went on to sign with Fuel Bar Ramen. So I guess we had a slight relationship with them, but not really. I think
it was a somewhat connection. It was knew them, but didn't really directly work with them yet.
Right, and we definitely had never met anyone there. So it was kind of a thing where we traded emails just to kind of get them set up so they could take over for August Premiere. You know, and then by the time grew and grew and grew, we, you know, then we were working with Remember Maine at the time, which was just William Beckett before the band. And then when he came to us and was like, hey, I got a full band now, you know, do you want to work with it? Which was the Academy. Yeah. We, you know, obviously we're like, yeah, but actually we were pretty pissed at first.
Because Remember Maine was going pretty well at the time.
Yeah. And it was our biggest seller by far. So we were like pretty bummed out because we were just getting started and on a roll and he just wanted to be in a band. And, so then, you know, it worked out to where we put out the EP and then, John Janik, my boss, who owns Fuel Bar Ramen, actually came up to see them play with Fall Out Boy. I think it was at the first Bottom Lounge.
Yeah, it was.
It was the old Bottom Lounge. And he stayed with us for the weekend, like I think two nights or something, because at the time me and Tony were living in an apartment with William and Mike Carden. And so he stayed with the four of us, and basically we just hung out and talked and got to know each other. And that was right at the time where he wanted to sign the Academy, but it was like a whole thing where, you know, we had him under contract and then we finally came to it. We're just like, you know, these are our great friends. Let's just, you know, let him go and go move on. And it was totally cool with us.
Was Fall Out Boy signed to Fill Baron?
Yes, Fall Out Boy's record was already out as well and doing well.
Yeah, it had already come out and everything. So it was a lot of like,
yeah, take this your grave.
They liked that and like, that's why we didn't want to hold them back.
Yeah, so it was like, you know, these are good friends. You know, it's our little label. So be it. It's a hobby. It's fun. But, you know, go for it. And I think they saw a lot in the whole process. And we, you know, once they signed to Fuel Bar Ramen, that was at the time when Fall Out Boy was really growing. You know, they had Academy and they also had just signed Gym Class Heroes, which both of those had a lot of steam going. So they were expanding. They were moving from Gainesville to Tampa as well at the same time. So when they made the move, they had come and asked, you know, at first I did retail there, which I kind of knew not a lot about. I only worked at a record store, so I didn't know the end of it from the label aspect, but I kind of talked to a few. It was a lot of learning going on, and I probably sucked a lot at it at first, but, you know, so it was.
And with retail, because I remember a long time ago when we were talking once, like when I was on tour or something, mm-hmm. something with you, like, because you were like in charge of like making sure that everything was in stores and stuff and that
right.
like, they have the built, like the posters.
Exactly. Absolutely. It had to do with a lot. Like, obviously, stocking was the number one priority of just making sure there's records in stores, which at the time, surprisingly, for most of those bands, it was really hard. Like, little stores did not care sometimes, you know, and then working with like Best Buy was really expensive. So I was always finding a nice balance of like, you know, luckily Fall Out Boy was blowing up enough to where they started to listen. And then, you know, we would have old stuff, throwback stuff like Jimmy Eat World EP, Yellow Card EP, stuff like that, that actually like, so they, you could spark their interest, and then you'd be like, oh, and by the way, I have this new band, Academy Is, Gym Class Heroes, kind of go into that. So it was a lot of like piggybacking to get them to listen, because a lot of places didn't have time, and you know, they didn't want to spend money on a band they didn't know or care about, you know. So then you'd have to do the tour sell, like, oh, they're coming through with so and so, which usually I think Academy toured with Fall Out Boy like every time.
A lot of
so it was a pretty easy thing to piggyback, be like, oh, you need more Take This to Your Grave records, well, here's this new band they're taking on tour, here's 10 posters, here's this, they could stop by for an in-store, you know, just whatever we needed to do to make sure they're going to have records while the band's coming through.
Okay. So, actually, question about that. So, from like a label standpoint, like, are there pretty much just like buyers at Best Buy and at these?
Yes. Okay. There's definitely retail distribution centers and like warehouses where you don't talk to the Best Buy in Arlington Heights. You talk to a Midwest regional. I mean, there's one main buy, and then they have separated ones to where, you know, some, we used to start all of our records different spots. Like, if it was a smaller band, we wouldn't just say, here's a full spread. Yeah, it would be a regional thing. It'd be like, okay, this band's from Michigan, let's do a Midwest spread. And then as we moved out, it was really hard, because if a band was on a full U.S. tour, it was really hard to get them to stock the record in certain areas, even though they were going there, because they just didn't have a real need for it. Yeah, and so it's like shelf space was shrinking at the same time, so they couldn't take chances anymore, so they had to be really strategic, which sucked for us, obviously. So, but yeah.
Well, I mean, it's cool, because it doesn't seem to really be an issue with Phil Barramen anymore, at least.
I mean, I think they believe us a little bit more now, after a couple of the CDs. It got a lot easier after, I think, the Panic at the Disco one, when we begged them to listen and listen and listen to us and stock more and more and more. Trust us. There's no sales history, but there's a demand. And I think, like, every Best Buy and Target sold out within, like, the first 3 days. And and they just were freaking out. So that from then on, I feel like we've had a lot better... you know, just way, yeah, I mean, the yeah, and they just believe us now. So if we're smarter too, we don't want to ship, you know, 50,000 records of a band we don't expect to sell 50,000 records within a first period, because all that does is we paid for all those physical goods and they get returned to us, and then we sit on them, and it sucks and it's really terrible. But you know, you can't put 20 records in Best Buy of a brand new band in every Best Buy across the country, and that's why people get all crazy on the internet about, like, that's such bullshit. I live in wherever, Pennsylvania, and they didn't stock the brand new, you know, whatever record it is. And it's like, well, yeah, they only could bring in 2 to 3 of them. They can't bring in 25. And
I mean, I guess if you're that big of a fan, I mean, you could hit up online retailers.
Yeah, I mean,
easily.
Yeah, the game's definitely changed, I think, now with online and, you know, definitely with iTunes. But if not, the band's always coming through on tour. There's usually pretty good indies in a lot of spot that actually do still care about, like, stocking bands that are working hard, and, you know,
nice.
It's definitely a balance, though.
And let me just, going back to the August premiere, so were they free agents then when they signed to Phil Barramen, or?
It wasn't free agents, but it wasn't under contract. It was kind of like a total, like, it was an okay thing, like, nobody was mad, nobody, it was like a mutual agreement.
And okay, because it just made sense for them. Yeah, like, I own that, that's, Fireworks and alcohol. And like, I didn't know if you had anything to do with them getting signed to them with that, because I mean, like how you work there now and stuff. Mm-hmm. I just didn't know how much involvement. So
I don't really remember how it came about. I think that Mickey, the drummer, was talking to Vinny, who at the time was co-owner, and I think it was just kind of a thing where they were looking. Like Tony said, it was like a handshake deal. That was our first record. We were just friends with the guys. And we were I think we were just as excited as them that Phil Barramen was interested. Because we were like, holy shit, like, this rules. Yeah. This is going to make our label better for the future. You know, whatever. Let's just do it. And then we actually ended up going back and re-releasing our record with bonus songs and new art and all that stuff. Because we, you know, there was more of a demand. It was, you know, a cool thing. But yeah, I don't think we had a lot to do with actually orchestrating the signing, I think.
I remember there was really much with that.
It was mostly them, so props to them.
Yeah.
All right, here is a song from August premieres Fueled by Ramen debut called Alcohol and Fireworks. This track is called Tuckered Out, and stay tuned for more interview from Tony and Johnny.
Well, moving on to some more A&R questions. As an A&R guy, what are qualities that you are looking for in a band right now?
Obviously, first and foremost is always songwriting, and you know, just something that you really can relate to or feel there's something special there. And you know, a lot that I look for, especially, is a lot of like hardworking bands. You know, just bands that, you know, willing to hit the road or, you know, make sure their hometown is always flyered. And I mean, a lot of days now it's like weird because everything's so super served that a band has to really have this online like rabid base but it's hard to balance that because you need so much content. And as a young band, it's hard to get content because, you're not going to go in the studio every month, you know? So there's like interesting ways where a lot of people nowadays do like the Ustream stuff because it's, you know, free and easy and it's just a free live thing where anyone can come. But I mean, it has to do with a lot of things. It's just, you know, when you meet people too, you can kind of get a sense of how they are and how excited they are and passionate about their own band. Where if you meet some bands on the road, they're just like, yeah, you know, whatever. We got offered this tour because my older brother knew this guy, you know, and you're just like, all right, well, that's cool. That's, you know, it's whatever. But then there's bands that are like literally like living in their vans and like they eat once a day because they don't have money for the rest, you know? So there's definitely that obviously weighs into it with someone so passionate and hardworking about it. I mean, it always relates all the way back to the music. And, you know, if it's something that you can, you know, drive around and listen to and be stoked on yourself, like there's not one band that I would ever sign if I didn't like listen to it or like,
you didn't jam on the,
yeah. Like when I get new demos, I'm genuinely excited, you know, not just for like, wow, people are going to love this or, you know, this might sell a lot of records, but it's like, it's really cool to just go and then like to then go on tour with the band and be like, wow, they're playing in front of 2,000 kids tonight. This is crazy. Like all that is rewarding in itself, but it goes back to the music at every point, you know?
Okay. So, yeah, I mean, it definitely makes sense that, obviously the songs are the product that's being sold, I guess.
Sure.
But yeah. I mean, if a band's not willing to push themselves, why should you guys be pushing them?
Exactly. And I think a lot of bands too forget that when you actually do have a label and there's staff working with you, it's a lot harder and you have to work harder. And it's not like a nice, we got signed, let's just wait for the tour bus to pick us up from our practice space.
That's definitely something that I remember when we got signed, because it was definitely like a weird growth of you're just shooting to get signed, you're shooting to get signed, and then once you do, it's like, okay.
You accomplished it, it's great.
You've entered the world of being a professional musician.
Sure.
I know that's when work starts.
And you start at the bottom of that, I think, which is so hard. And some bands, it's a rude awakening because, you know, you get your good tour, you get this, and then it goes away. And then the next tour you do, there's 15 people a night. And you're like, wow, I kind of took that all for granted. I didn't go out and sign for every kid that I just played in front of. And now, wow, we're starting over kind of. And people have already heard of us. And, you know, you kind of have a slower start then. Yeah. So.
All right, well, you kind of touched on this a little bit before, but what were some bands at Field by Ramen that you were involved with the signing of?
There have been, there's six that are basically that I have brought in and worked with daily. There's others that obviously we as a label always talk about, and before we sign bands, usually we're all pretty well aware and like excited about. But the first one in order was actually Forgive Durden was the first one. Okay. Second one was This Providence. Third one was Friday Night Boys. Fourth one, A Rocket to the Moon. And then Power Space. Okay. And The Swellers is the newest one, which is the newest band on our label as a whole.
Nice. Yeah, I like The Swellers record a lot.
Awesome.
And I remember Mickey, who's on our show as well, he was very, very excited and hit me up like that night or something. I remember when that got announced. And that was pretty sweet. And I don't know. I just also think that, especially with them, like they don't have what you'd expect, like the average now Field by Ramen band kind of sound. And I appreciate a lot that you guys brought that in. And I don't know, I think that they're a sweet band, and I hope that things keep growing and stuff.
I mean, they've had a good run thus far. I mean, that's a lot of people don't know Field by Ramen pre Fall Out Boy, but I mean, Fall Out Boy, I think, was the 63rd release Field by Ramen had.
Wow.
Or 61st, one of the two. And prior to that was mostly bands that were less like power pop, like the stuff we have now, and we're way more like, you know, the grittier punk rock, like, you know, a lot different sounding. And then they started to develop into like the Stereo, which was way more along the lines of Fall Out Boy and, you know, Cadillac Blindside and stuff like that, that just definitely kind of started changing over. And I think Fall Out Boy was definitely like the first, obviously, one that broke through, but there was like Punchline and August Premiere right before Fall Out Boy.
Yeah, I definitely love Punchline. And,
yeah.
I hope fan. For nothing but the best of those dudes.
Yeah, they're still kicking. It's awesome. They still put out great records, and they're doing really cool stuff, I think, with the, a lot of the, their own label, which is cool, because that's kind of, I feel like, what they've wanted to do for a while.
Nice. Okay, so I'm going to ask this question. If you can't give me an answer, that's cool.
I know what this one is.
Yeah. Okay, so not playing favorites, but... do you, by any chance, have a favorite band on Fueled by Ramen at the moment? Or is there a band that you've been jamming on super hard on Fueled by Ramen lately?
Can it be anyone from the history?
Sure.
Anything? Yeah,
past or present.
Well, I grew up loving The Stereo. That was one of my favorite bands, and that's what I think turned me on to Fueled by Ramen, besides Less Than Jake, which obviously... it's kind of done one-off releases, so it's hard for me. Less Than Jake's definitely one of my favorites ever, but I don't really consider them as much of a full-time Fueled by Ramen artist. So I would definitely say The Stereo, or I would definitely go back to Fall Out Boy even, just because I still think that Fall Out Boy has not written a bad song ever, which not a lot of bands can do that or say that.
Yeah.
They have a solid-ass discography.
Yeah, so I kind of would go back to them. Actually, today was the first day we had the windows down. We were rocking Take This to Your Grave at lunch, and it was real nice to go all the way back. I was like, God, I missed this. So
That is definitely a windows down summer.
Yep, it's a feel good record for sure.
First nice day record.
Awesome. All right, then I guess last question for A&R stuff. What are some bands that you're jamming on now? Like that people might not have heard of. I mean, it doesn't have to do with anything you've signed or anything. Just bands you're jamming
on. Just other bands?
Yeah. I mean, it could be anything.
There's a lot of stuff, actually. I mean, there's this band, The Dangerous Summer, that it put out an amazing record that I love. I believe Hopeless Records. Lately I've been on a weird country kick, like Zach Brown Band and Luke Bryan, which I guess you probably wouldn't know, but just kind of a bunch of different stuff. I've been going back lately and pulling out older records. Like, we were going through this whole drive-thru phase where I would pull out, like, Finch or Movie Life and Something Corporate after Twitter was basically Something Corporate's journal the whole weekend with the Bamboozle reunion, and now they're coming back for a full tour. So kind of went back to that and Jack's Mannequin lately. New Motion City Soundtrack record's amazing. The band Fun, Format, all that stuff, I think, has been pretty heavy rotation lately.
Okay.
And the new Deftones.
Yeah, you can't forget that one.
New Deftones record's
that's
amazing.
Been a heavy cycle lately,
but it's not out yet.
It was supposed to be pretty awesome, and it's a band that I never got into, but it's just like a weird thing with that.
I think they're one of the best that they've done.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I mean, the people who have told me that it's pretty sweet, I do appreciate their musical opinions, so I'm going to check it out. I've got a weird high school like time.
Yeah.
If you know this kid John Adriani, he used to tell me that every band that I like sucked and that I was a sellout, and now I listen to the Deftones. And so because of that, I've got this like weird beef with that band.
Good, I hear you. They've slumped for the last 5 years or so, but they're back. They're definitely, this is a great record, but
cool. We'll have to check that out.
Yeah. I think it comes out in May, so check it out then.
Yeah. May 5th.
Not out yet. I guess just a couple of random questions for the both of you.
Sure.
This is just more like in between all those things. Since you guys did own your own record company at one point, what advice would you give to anybody trying to start their own label? And just how have things changed? Obviously it's changed a lot since...
Absolutely.
Yeah, the industry's completely different now than when we started, because actual hard copy CDs are so hard to come by nowadays, and it's completely different.
Yeah.
Like, if we printed 1,000 CDs, we would plan on selling 1,000 CDs, but now you have more chance, especially with a smaller band, of selling digitally.
Tracks and all that
and
stuff.
And singles, and it's really hard to sell full, especially a hard copy full record to a brand new band.
Yeah, it's definitely, I mean, what did we end? I think we ended in 2004.
Yeah.
So if you could believe, we never sold a single LLR song digitally.
Yeah.
Or a record.
It was ever digital.
It was right before, because I think it was just like the iTunes and all that stuff was just coming out, but it was super hard to get involved and behind it.
Yeah.
It was hard for them to get them to sell our stuff, even though it's not like warehouse space. It was just weird. Strange. So it was just
like
super
they were
hard
in the beginning.
Yeah, I don't think
and now it's kind of like whatever.
Yeah, now on. Yeah, like we could probably put a song up. We could put this interview up tonight. You know what I mean? Like if you wanted to. But I mean, as far as any of advice, I don't know. I'd say just the advice we had always heard from way back in the day was always just do what you love. Yep. You know, only sign bands that you love, because that way when you're looked on as like, if you, I guess, quote unquote, fail, at least you were doing what you loved. And that's why, you know, any one label makes it, I think. It's not so much of being a smart businessman all the time. It's a lot of it is you were doing something you were really passionate about. And that, I think, you know, starts spreading. It's very contagious when you love something as much as, you know, obviously your own label, your hard work and your money's going into it. But there's these bands that are also working hard, and you kind of form this big bond where, you know, unless you're super passionate, it's very obvious that you, oh, let's just sign that band because I think they're going to be the next Fall Out Boy. And that happens so often, even on large labels. And that's why I think, you know, a lot of the stuff doesn't work anymore.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Yeah, I think definitely having passion is a huge thing. If you don't have passion, it doesn't work. It just becomes, then it becomes a job instead of something you want to do.
Yeah.
It doesn't work like that. Mm-hmm. You have to love what you do. If you don't love what you do, it never works.
I mean, yeah, we were basically working full-time jobs and then working another full-time job when we got home.
Yeah.
Till 2 a.m, whether it be packing mail orders and, or, you know, just being online, doing stuff we thought we were supposed to, which looking back was probably most of it a huge waste of time.
Yeah. I definitely remember checking out tracks on mp3.com.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Back in the day, or like the GeoCities or the CJB.net sites.
Yeah.
Yeah, I actually have a whole list of things that I someday want to put out to kids today and labels today of how things used to be, even though, I mean, I'm not that old yeah. experience, but how it was, you know, even 7-8 years ago of, you know, how crazy hard it was, like bands today that get signed off not playing shows and all that stuff, where it's like we had bands that have played 152 and when we signed Gatsby's American Dream, they were playing over 200 shows a year, you know, without a booking agent. They were just doing it. They were just going crazy because they really, really believed in it. And obviously that was so contagious that a lot of people caught on, and management and label and all that stuff. So, you know, I guess going back, it's always about doing what you love. And I think the dude that first told us that was Richard from Drive Thru, and he was always the one that was saying, you know, just don't, you know, never bullshit. And I think that's why that guy got, that label got so large so quick, because I think like their huge record was Nothing Gold Can Stay, or no, Phoenix TX even. And
yeah,
I think
Phoenix
it was,
TX was their first big one.
And that was like only like,
song, like kind of blow them up.
It did, but Phoenix TX still did really well
there.
For them.
Phoenix TX got in the door, and that first record where he first said River Phoenix on the blue and yellow one, that. And they got really big in like 15 records. I think that was like their 15th release or something. And then like the next 20 releases were all those monsters, the Starting Lines and the Something Corporates, Newfound Glories, you know? Whereas most labels, like I said, you know, they put out so many records before it's like that scale. So it's like, obviously that was a guy we always looked up to, and it was super nice that, you know, the questions basically that you're asking us, we asked him.
Yeah.
And he was so nice and supportive that he was just like, yeah, why don't you, if you're ever in LA, come by the office. And
hey, you guys did a split sampler with
yeah,
that.
Yeah, sampler.
Because yeah, I remember being at the Displays Theater one night and Sean Van Fleet came up to me.
Yeah.
Like, super pumped about that. And he's like, dude, check this out.
Absolutely.
I remember I was like 16 or something at the time, and I remember thinking that was the coolest thing.
Oh, dude.
Like,
we were so stoked. Yeah. Like, that was a big step for our career.
And that was amazing. Yeah, because he was basically like, if you put together a sampler and tell us what you want, we'll pay for half. Which, who would say that without like knowing or believing? Yeah. Like, he was just like, yeah, if you find something and, you know, just get me a quote and we'll write you a check for half of it. And it was like, what? Like, it's hard to imagine labels doing that today for like, we had only known him probably for a year at that point.
Yeah.
Met him once, you know. But, and going back to Sean Van Vliet, I'm also listening to The Empires a lot, too.
Good
That's
record.
Another good...
Great record.
Nice. Yeah, on the debut show that we had last week, we definitely were rocking some Empires.
Nice.
So.
Nice.
This is a song from the Dangerous Summer's last album, Reach for the Sun. It is the first track on the record. It is called Where I Wanna Be.
Crazy, and there is something in your face. darkest now, and in my coming out, I let you live. I wish you'd try to save me. Your silence makes me crazy. It takes a lot to say that something is fate. I gotta know where you're headed. Am I too upfront, or am I just on time? Where is your head at? And there is something in your face that pulls me far enough away. I guess that I always knew that I'd find you when I thought I reached my point. I let them down. I sunk in the worst part of this town. You are my song, and you are where I wanna be. Steps I never have. I need to stand up straight so I can feel your breath. I really think for once that I can change. It's really not that bad. I'm learning now that I was wrong in everything, and that's the reason why I think that I can grow. It's really not that bad. It's in the way you had. It's in the way you had me all wrapped up. Like I'm a part of something finally, and I'm never looking back. And there is something in your face that pulls me far enough away. I guess that I always knew that I'd find you when I thought I reached my point. I let them down. I slept in the worst part of this town. You are my song, and you are where I wanna be. I reached my point. I let them down. I slept in the worst part of this town. You are my song, and you are where I wanna be.
All right, well, to take us out this week, from Owl City's platinum certified record, Ocean Eyes, is track 7 on the album, Meteor Shower. See you guys next week.